Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And at 2:35 on the afternoon of October 27th, 1904, that would be 106 years ago today, the New York City subway system opened for its first run. 36 years after that, in 1940, the infamous John Gotti was born in the Bronx. As part of the History Channel's interactive history experience, you can see exactly what happened today in history on their website every day as part of their series on America called The Story of Us. And one of the most compelling parts of that multimedia experience is a new book, America, The Story of Us, An Illustrated History. You might call it a textbook like you've never seen a textbook before. The story of the 400 years of American history is captured in beautiful full-page pictures, and the book seeks to provide a complete story of the American experience from the ground up. Kevin Baker, maybe you know him as the novelist of Dreamland and other books, historian, is now the author of the book version of America, The Story of Us, and he joins us now to share his stories, other stories, our stories. Hey, Kevin, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And listeners, we're going to open up the phones on this for your family stories and how they contribute to the story of us as a nation. How does your family story, either from generations ago or today, fit into a narrative arc of the story of America? Have you given it that kind of thought, putting your family story in the context of America's story? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. This is our on-air number, not our pledge number. We'll never ask you for money on the air. So call up and talk about your family story in the context of America's story, 212-433-9692. And Kevin, why go grand on a story of all of American history? Why not drill down on a specific time, place, or person?
You can't help but go grand with American history. The idea was for History Channel and for the people at Newtopia who produced this to do kind of the whole big story and to employ sort of a new form of documentary making, bringing in the CGI and all kinds of things to just sort of show how the country came to be at one big gulp. And that's a lot of the idea behind the book, too. We try to take various themes and run with them, you know, instead of keeping it all the time in strict chronological order. We'll talk about going west. We'll talk about industrial development and kind of do that over a big swath of years and then go back. So it's kind of a great way to look at the country.
Specifically, let's take an example.
Okay.
We'll drill down a little on an oft-studied historical moment, the Civil War.
Right.
And one of the things you have is a demographic comparison chart between the Union soldiers and the Confederate soldiers. You want to walk us through that, what you chose to focus on in the Civil War and on that?
Sure. I mean, what we focused on was sort of the immense kind of industrial advantage the Union soldiers had, much more equipment, an incredible amount of, you know, of industry behind them, the railroads, the telegrams. You know, the North was really a kind of a modern industrial society already, fighting that war against the agrarian South, and this kind of, I hope, brings it across in this chart. You know, it's one of the amazing things about the Civil War too was the immense amount of invention it spurred, incredible number of patents every year in the North for things even that weren't related necessarily to the to the war. We go through them there. But, all kinds of things were being invented. You know, kind of pre-made clothing was coming into its own. They started doing canned meats. All these sorts of things were happening during the Civil War. You know, war, horribly enough, can be a sort of great boost
a
to an economy.
To innovation and to an economy. It's true. I think we've kind of flipped on that. We know how World War II helped to bring the United States out of recession,
right,
but the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have been a drain on the U.S. economy.
Yeah, which is interesting. That maybe now we've moved beyond the need for them. Unfortunately, we're still having them.
You told my producer before the show that you're interested in stories of what people have chosen to do for work over the years.
Right.
And so there's one picture in the book of a huge line of women constructing what looked to be airplane bodies, very
sure.
Rosie the Riveter. so what do you think is significant about about that image, or what else are you looking at in terms of work?
Oh, well, that's an incredible part. You know, the women made an invaluable contribution to the American war effort. We had a huge advantage over Germany in that, which was very reluctant to put women in the workplace. For one of the reasons, we greatly outproduced everybody. And, you know, women never went back. You know, there was never – a lot of women went back from their wartime jobs, but they never moved out of the workforce again to the levels that had existed before the war. You know, so this was sort of in many ways the start of feminism, the start of women in the workplace in the modern era.
Let's take a phone call. We have a full board of calls. People want to tell their family stories in the context of the story of America. And Oscar in South Salem, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Hey. Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I want to add my family story to this conversation. It's a family that has spent the last five generations entertaining people on Broadway in the New York City theater. The Hammerstein family started building theaters in Times Square, entertaining them through vaudeville, operetta, musical comedies, and then my grandfather did the lyric writing for the best.
Your grandfather was Oscar Hammerstein?
Yes, he was. I consider this family to actually count as a family that really has contributed to a general story of the United States.
Absolutely.
I guess so.
And how do you even see the story of the Hammerstein family, not only as making a major contribution to culture in America, obviously so, but also reflecting something of the times in which your grandfather lived or any other way that you might look at it?
The easy answer is that they had to cater to a changing audience, and that changing audience, in fact, determines what's a hit and what's a failure. So to study my family is to study the changing tastes of an American audience. And since we are all an audience of sorts at this point in America, you're able to look at entertainment at a time when the New York City theater was the story, not one of many, but really the epicenter of entertainment in America. So it's a great way to study the audience.
Very, very much so, and very much like the city really influenced how kind of American entertainment evolved. You know, the word vaudeville comes from voix de vie, the voice of the city. And it was, you know, this was sort of a modern kind of urban art form. You'd go into a theater, you'd see a couple acts while you were, you know, waiting for the wife or while you were out shopping, and then you'd leave there. You know, and this is sort of how this kind of evolved through New York's history and through America's.
And I have to admit, I have chills talking to this generation of Oscar Hammerstein, talking about his grandfather and his family. So, Oscar, thank you so much for calling.
My pleasure. Thanks for taking my call.
And chiming in. Don in Tom's River, you're on WNYC. Hi, Don.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Quick story I thought might add to the discussion. My great-great-grandfather immigrated from Ireland back in the 1840s. He almost didn't make it. He fell off the boat in Dublin Harbor and was retrieved and pulled back on the boat. Came to the United States, joined the U.S. Army, fought in the Mexican War, lost one of his arms, rose to the level of brigadier general in the Civil War, participated at Shiloh and Wilson's Creek with General Grant. And the fact that a situation that most Americans don't realize, he was part of what was called the Stenian Uprising, where the United States, or their group, actually tried to invade Canada, where they were going to try to hold Quebec as hostage from the English and then trade it back in return for Ireland.
You know that story?
Oh, the Fenians, yeah. Yeah.
Fill us in on that,
Oh, yeah.
Kevin.
No, this was one reason, one motivation for a tremendous patriotism for the most part. But one reason a lot of Irish soldiers joined up was the Civil War. They were feeling this is going to be a good way to learn to fight, and then they were going to kind of take it back to England and free Ireland, starting by invading Canada. But now, what is your father's name?
My father was Charles T. Sweeney, but my great-grandfather was Tom Sweeney. He was called, nicknamed by his crew, Fighting Tom Sweeney.
That's great.
And he was fighting on both north and south borders, or at least he was ready to.
Well, you know, and it's a really interesting thing about American identity. You know, it mentions the Mexican War, and there were a group of Irish being treated very badly in the American army who deserted during the Mexican War, went over to the Mexican side, felt they shouldn't be fighting against a Catholic country, and formed an artillery brigade called the San Patricios, or St. Patrick's. Some of them were captured in the war. They fought very well by the Americans and were hanged as traitors. and they were put up on scaffolding overlooking Mexico City during the final assault on the fortress there by the Americans, and told when the American flag went up that they would be hanged. And so they're watching this, and all through the battle and the smoke, the flag goes up there, and they cheered, which always struck me as so amazing. Is that some kind of residual feeling for their what had been their countrymen, or not, or some kind of laughing in the face of death? And then they hang them, and it's amazing story.
Don, thank you for your call. Let's do one more before we break, as we're taking your calls about how your family's story fits in to the story of America with Kevin Baker, author of America, the Story of Us. And Lamar in Woodhaven, you're on WNYC. Hey, Lamar, thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you, Brian? Great show. I love your show. Listen every day.
Thank you.
I was just going to say that this whole thing is pretty interesting. It made me think about the fact that my family, you know, migrated up. I'm African American. I migrated up during the early 1950s with the Great Migration. They lived in Harlem. You know, they witnessed a lot of the Harlem Renaissance and everything else. And then in the early 1960s, they moved over to Teaneck, New Jersey, and were one of the early first families to actually, one of the first black families to actually live in the town. So I'm always intrigued by how, you know, especially, you know, if you're African American, how your family kind of traces that history, because I'm from a generation of three college graduates. My grandmother graduated from college in 1941, and my sister always jokes around calling her the first black woman to ever graduate from college, but I know that's not the case. So I think that what you're doing is great, and I really like the conversation.
Thank you, Lamar. Thank you very much. And I think it says something that someone could feel that somebody in their family who went to college was so rare in the cultural context of this country that they could call her, even jokingly, the first black woman to go to college.
Right. And it was one of the amazing things about Harlem. You know, I wrote a historical novel called Stryver's Row set in Harlem, too. And it's just amazing to realize, you know, we kind of use the words ghetto and slum interchangeably, but they're really different things. And Harlem was a ghetto in the sense that the old Jewish ghettos in Europe were. You know, a place where everyone who was a person of color was sort of forced to live there and a couple other little enclaves throughout New York, which meant you had people who were, you know, you had boxers living next to surgeons, living next to teachers, next to, you know, next to ministers. It was sort of an amazing, you know, it gave Harlem a lot of its kind of amazing flavor and a lot of its amazing kind of ferment, intellectual and cultural in those days, you know.
We'll continue after the break with Kevin Baker, author of America, the Story of Us, an Illustrated History, which goes with the History Channel's interactive series, an online experience. And we'll take more calls from you about your family stories and how they fit into larger arcs of American history. Narrative, 212-433-WNYC, if you want to chime in, 212-433-9692. And we continue now with Kevin Baker, author of America, the Story of Us, an Illustrated History, which goes with a History Channel series and interactive website, where you can see exactly what happened today in history. And we're taking your calls on how you think your family's history fits into larger narratives of American history. And we'll get back to some of your calls in just a minute. Kevin, thanks again for doing this. Tell us a couple of stories. For example, we mentioned earlier that today happens to be the birthday, October 27th, of the New York City subway system, which opened for its first run 106 years ago today. And that comes up in the book?
We mention it. Yeah, it's one of the amazing kind of things that New York built that's really irreplaceable, more than even than the tall buildings that were going up that were so spectacular. The great kind of turn-of-the-century accomplishment was the subway. And the first run was made by Mayor George McClellan, son of the Civil War general of the same name. He was just supposed to start the subway, but instead he insisted on taking the throttle and running the subway at speeds that scared the engineer to death. But, you know, the amazing thing is to read about it. New Yorkers were literally dancing and singing in the streets when the subway went into action. They were ecstatic about it. They wrote songs about it, had parades, and were horrified when about a week or so into its existence, the MTA, well, what was then the New York City Transit Board, announced they were going to put up advertisements in these stations. They felt it was a desecration. They couldn't believe they would advertise in something so beautiful.
Now they wrap whole trains in Monroe College signs and things like that.
And nobody blinks.
Jim in Rye, thanks for calling. You're on WNYC. Jim, are you there? We'll come back to Jim. Another story that I know you love from the book is that of the Lowell Mill girls.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. This book is a lot about working people and how they manage to survive. And the Lowell story is amazing. I mean, here are these girls, really teenage girls, coming from the farms to Lowell, this first model industrial town in New England and America, and working 14 hours a day and still putting out in their spare time a literary magazine, the Lowell Offering, that Dickens was astonished by and admired. You know, they were spending every spare minute improving themselves, learning music, going to lectures. You know, they were mad for reading. They would go and, like, kind of take apart books, and the books were banned in the mills themselves. Because these girls were working these, like, 12, they'd often work 12 power mills apiece. And these were huge, scary machines. You can go up there and go to the museum still, and the noise is deafening. But they were just mad for reading, so they would paste up pages where they could see them, and in any spare moment, read a little bit more, you know, and do this.
Certainly shows incredible. The progression of opportunity for women in this country.
Yes.
And how gradual it was. We had a caller who, unfortunately, I think hung up, Rana in Manhattan, who was going to say her grandmother was once written up in the New York Times as housewife gets doctorate. Art in Newark. You're on WNYC. Hi, Art.
Yes, hello. Hi. Every opportunity I get, I'd like to talk about my great-great-great-grandfather, my grandmother's grandfather.
Wow.
And every time you would mention him, she would say, oh, what a great man. And I would say, you know, we called a lady. And I said, lady, what did he do? And she said, he was a weatherman. And we would laugh at that because, you know, we think about what a weatherman is.
Yeah.
I said, well, what did he do as a weatherman? Well, first of all, he was the last slave, and he owned a farm. Mm-hmm. And he learned to read the clouds and the movement of the stars in the heavens, and was able to accurately predict what crops should be planted. And he did that for an area in Bisco, North Carolina, and became a very successful man in his own right, and raised six young girls and two men and my own grandmother. So he did very, very well for himself.
And did you tell our screener that he was a slave during all this?
He was the last slave in our family.
Wow.
Yeah,
he was the last slave in our family, so we were very, very proud of him. Yeah, there are a million stories like that, I'm sure, from people.
Absolutely.
He has a brother that also shot rabbits and lost an arm and learned to shoot with the other arm and could handle a sawed-off shotgun with one arm and never miss a rabbit.
And it's great that the story of somebody, you know, back that far has been handed down and handed down in your family.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah, it's amazing the way African Americans made their way out of bondage, you know, what that meant, both escaping and surviving in a slave society, how much you had to know, you know, the ways in which they went about finding ways to, learn to read when it was often banned legally in many states. An incredible story.
Elizabeth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and you?
Okay. I wanted to tell the story of my paternal grandparents that I think that many Americans do not know, that there was a sizable group of black people who came from the West Indies,
right,
who came on ships and went through Ellis Island as immigrants. Most people think that it's the Russians, the Jews, the Italians that came. And I think largely the story of black people who came with the immigrant story that America thinks of, people
sure.
looking at the Statue of Liberty and coming past her into America. And they came, my grandmother was 19, my grandfather was 26, and I found verification of this by going through the archives at Ellis Island, and they came in 1905 on a ship called the Fontebelle, and they had $30, and they were sponsored by a doctor in Brooklyn to come to America, and my grandfather was educated in Guyana as a chiropractor, and because of the laws and discrimination in New York at that time, the laws did not recognize chiropractic as a medical discipline in that era.
So
he had to work as a Pullman porter on the railroad, and my grandmother became a seamstress and sewed clothing for people in the theater.
And I'm going to have to leave it there and move on to some other folks, but how instructive that, first of all, who knew they had chiropractic at that time? And we never think of black people as coming through Ellis Island.
Ellis Island, and there are pictures. If you go to the museum in Ellis Island, there are pictures of black women dressed beautifully.
Elizabeth, thank you.
Yeah, the Caribbean American population made very important contributions, particularly here in New York. And the Pullman Porters, of course, were organized into an amazing union by A. Philip Randolph that became one of the pillars of the civil rights movement. Another fun thing about Ellis Island that I love to tell people, it's almost nobody's name was changed at Ellis Island. The clerks were very professional, and they were going off the ship manifest, because if you were not somebody who qualified to come into the U.S., you were sent back at the expense of the shipping company. So nobody was changing anyone's name. They were going about it very officially. This is something that Americans have told their kids over the generations when probably they themselves changed their names.
Wow, and most people have no idea. Yeah. Rob in Milburn has a story about how his family's history fits into a broader story of American history. Rob, thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, I'll be very brief. My father owned a speakeasy in Newark, on Brantford Place in Newark, and it's where he met my mother. There's a lot more to the story, but I know there's other people you want to speak to. Can I say a little more?
Of course.
Well, my mother was taken there by a boyfriend she had at the time, and they were introduced, or my father introduced himself. He would walk around the place and speak to the patrons in his place. And my mother, I always believed that my father figured out a way to hit on her, but my sister, who is older than me, tells me that it was not that way. My mother went back with a girlfriend and was able to get in because she had been there before, and it was my mother who hit on my father.
What else did they tell you about the speakeasy and the context of, you know, running that kind of business?
Well, the only other thing that my father told very little. This is a story that my mother told, and I guess I got a slightly different version because I was younger. I don't know, but at the time my father met my mother, it was the 1929. So you know what was going on. The
crash
was about to end. As Prohibition ended, that went his business. But he had made many contacts, as you would know, in Newark, and was able to survive through the many contacts that he knew and to raise a family based largely on people that he knew. And
did he just open a legit bar, or did he go into something else?
No, he never did open another legit bar. As a matter of fact, my father never drove. He owned a car, but he had a driver during this period when he was doing well. Yeah. And he would find a way to support his family. A job here, a job there, a job at City Hall in Newark, working at the shipyards during the war. My father was a very adaptable person. I can go on a little further.
And, Rabbi, I'm going to have to leave it there, but thank you for that wonderful story. And maybe the adaptability is one of the big narratives in the story of us.
Very much so. I mean, this is just a nation of improvisers, of innovators. You know, it's incredible the way in which kind of Americans make do, you know, and the way they've adapted their democracy to a world that has changed constantly. America's really the first modern nation, has existed wholly in the modern age, of which the trademark characteristic is change. You know, and we're a bunch of people who can go with the changes.
Now, before you go, you've written other things. Some people know you, my guest Kevin Baker, from some of your novels.
Right.
You've written a baseball novel and a baseball history. Your most recent work on the fiction side is Dreamland, set in New York City, Once Upon a Time. What's the difference between writing about New York in a novel at the turn of the last century and writing a chapter in a history book?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I get a lot of people ask me, why don't you just write straight history? What I'm trying to do with the historical novels, and this is one of three set in New York, Paradise Alley, Dreamland, and Stryver's Row, was kind of bring these great historical events down on a human level. What was it like working at the Triangle Factory? What was it like being in the middle of the draft riots in New York City in the 1860s? What was it like being in Harlem in the 1940s? you know, trying to get make these kind of more than just the overarching historical story, great as that is, but kind of honing it down to the individual level. And I hope they work on that level.
And the book is called America, The Story of Us, An Illustrated History. Thanks so much. This has been great.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, from the story of us to the story of our language, as we continue our series with Leslie Dunton Downer on the global reach and global roots of English, words in from other languages, words out as global English. We'll give some more examples coming up.